From the headquarters of the United Nations Development Program, this is Learning for Nature, the podcast about nature, people, and sustainability. I'm your host, Julie Capovari. For this episode, we're joined by Victor Lopez Carmen, the co-chair of the UN Global Indigenous Youth Caucus. Victor is from Tucson, Arizona, and he is a member of the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe in South Dakota, with Yaqui heritage as well. Victor was named a 2018 Native American 40 Under 40 Award recipient, and last year he worked as a legislative fellow clerking for the U.S. House Natural Resources Subcommittee for Indigenous Peoples. Currently, he is attending Harvard Medical School, where he serves as the co-president of the Native American Health Organization. Welcome, Victor.
Thanks for having me, Julie.
Thanks so much for making the time for this conversation, Victor. Let me start off by asking you, what first inspired you to start advocating for Native American, Indian, and Indigenous people's rights? Was there a particular event that led you on this path?
Yeah, so for me, my family was a huge inspiration. Both my parents were activists in the American Indian Rights Movement and the movements that stemmed from that. So I grew up going to protests, going to movements, actions. I was definitely a protest baby. That's how they made money as well, being organizers. So they were fully enveloped in every way. I grew up going to protests for our sacred sites, for water, for the sacred sites from other Indigenous nations. And so I just grew up around people who really cared about our rights and our land and our languages and cultures. And that really, I think, got me started off on that path. And then circumstances around me, my family, watching people I love struggle. And that, I think, was tied into the systemic issues that were really hurting my people in terms of poverty, the intergenerational trauma from years of policies that have neglected us or taken away our rights, our foundations, and put us in positions where a lot of people are prone to, you know, not being able to live the healthiest lives like our ancestors did. So I wanted to figure out a way that I could help. And I know that regaining our rights and having our rights respected is one of the best ways that we can get back to living what a healthy life means to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really, really inspiring, Victor. It's so important to muster up the courage to demonstrate and protest against systemic injustices like that. And I really commend you and your family for taking that on.
Thank you.
Also, back in 2014, you joined the UN Global Indigenous Youth Caucus, and soon thereafter became the co-chair, and you're the current co-chair now as well. Could you tell me a bit about the mission of the UN Global Indigenous Youth Caucus and its goals?
Yeah. So I joined the Global Indigenous Youth Caucus my freshman year of undergrad, and it was random chance. And I show up at the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, which is, I believe, the largest, if not the second largest, gathering at the United Nations.
Really?
In terms of, they invite thousands of Indigenous representatives. And so at the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, thousands of Indigenous peoples come to deliver statements about how countries can better respect their rights in the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And so that's what I was going for. I was just one Indigenous youth going to learn and to talk and to listen. And I get there and it's just a lot. It's a lot to handle. It's overwhelming. You're mm-hmm. hearing a lot of really traumatic stories and everyone's trying to figure it out. And then the Global Indigenous Youth Caucus found me. And it's a group, at that time, a group of Indigenous youth. They were a formally recognized caucus of this United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. And their official caucus housed in that, which the UNPFII, Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, advises ECOSOC, and it's housed in Department of Economic and Social Affairs. And so as a caucus, we represent Indigenous youth and the voices of Indigenous youth in that space. At the time, it was just the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, but now we represent Indigenous youth in various streams in the United Nations. We go to the climate negotiations, we go to food security meetings with the Food and Agriculture Organization, among others. So it's a tremendous opportunity, I think, for Indigenous youth. We've been growing as a caucus and getting, you know, stronger and stronger, and I think it's really allowing us to make an impact on the UN system when it comes to hearing our voices.
Yeah, I remember my first UN conference was also very, very overwhelming. But in your case, yeah. I really can't imagine what it must have been like. Just probably very emotional to be in that kind of room of all those people from all over the world, and also being part of that conversation. And so when you joined the UN Indigenous Youth Caucus, what was the biggest challenge of representing Native American and Indigenous peoples on the international stage?
Yeah, it's hard for a lot of Indigenous peoples. They show up, and when you think of the United Nations, I think people think of many different things. One of them is that, like, the UN can fix all things, or if you're going to the UN, there are certain assumptions about what happens. Mm-hmm. I think people think the UN is like some change mechanism, and I think a lot of people like are really impressed by it, but don't know how what happens after, or what happens from there, or what do you do with the knowledge that you gained, or how do you lobby for what you went there for after. And I find that a lot of Indigenous peoples go and they might get to deliver a statement, they might not figure it out the first time, and they go back to their communities, and I think it's difficult to translate it back, because a lot of people are expecting change, and it's difficult to translate it back because the UN is a system that wasn't really designed for us to understand. It wasn't designed for us at all. And so for Indigenous peoples, I think one of the huge challenges is translating what goes on at the UN, the knowledge of how the UN works and how our human rights are recognized, you know, in these international treaties, and beyond that, how to just translate the actions to the ground level in our own communities. And part of this, I think, is because when we go to the UN as Indigenous peoples, part of this challenge also is the trauma. You hear so many sad and terrible and horrifying stories when you're there, because it's Indigenous peoples coming from all across the globe, 90 different countries, talking about colonization, talking about the really horrifying issues that their people are facing due to factors that were kind of out of their control, that they were subjected and oppressed. And you realize, yeah, I'm not the only one, which is a beautiful thing, but it's also really hard to continue to listen to over and over and over again in 2-minute statements from Indigenous peoples' representatives. So sometimes I think you need to take a break and have fun and share culture. And we try to do that. We try to lighten up the atmosphere as well. But it does end up getting to you, especially if you're in a leadership position, like I'm in. You hear a lot of people reaching out, telling you about just really, really sad and trying times that their communities are facing, and seeing if you can do anything to help. And then I found the UN system, when it comes to Indigenous youth, I found it to be very tokenistic. Mm-hmm. Indigenous youth, a lot of times we're just invited to give a song or a prayer in our language, not really given space at the tables.
To actually speak and give your perspective.
Yeah, and so that becomes hard. And a lot of Indigenous youth they really want to participate and take an active role. But there's currently not really an avenue for us to be formally or institutionally supported. We have the Global Indigenous Youth Caucus, but really no funding streams in the United Nations for Indigenous youth specifically, no technical support when it comes to organizing. And, you know, we don't get paid for any of this. And I think it would help us tremendously to be more effective if there was some technical support or some formalized mechanism to focus on us, because Indigenous youth are the future, and 70 to 80% of the biodiversity left on the planet is in our lands. And once our elders pass on, it's going to be us. And I just like the UN to see that and put some actions behind that, that reality.
Mm-hmm. You say a lot of important things, Victor, and I have so many things spinning through my brain right now as you're talking, because I totally 100% agree with you. So as you might know, Learning for Nature is on the same team as the Equator Initiative, and that is...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's really cool. The Equator Initiative tries to emphasize storytelling of Indigenous peoples across the world, so others could learn from their stories that are drawn from Indigenous knowledge. And so they are a platform to elevate the voices and make space for those Indigenous peoples in the conversation. But of course, there is always more that needs to be done. And we really need to, I completely agree with what you said. It's really important to not tokenize these Indigenous peoples and their solutions. And the UN may or may not be the best mechanism for that, but it is a knowledge-sharing platform. But even the Equator Initiative completely relies on the peoples on the ground and at the grassroots level who are actually implementing these solutions. And I went to COP24, and that was when the government of Fiji put forth the Talanoa Dialogue. I don't know if you know much about that, but I thought that was so important and such an interesting way to have quality inputs to the UN conversations.
I think the Equator Initiative is like one of the best programs and best examples. I have colleagues who are also involved in that, and I've been in contact with Indigenous peoples who've won. And yeah, I think it's just amazing. I think the way that it recognizes these Indigenous knowledge as a solution is just quite an example that a lot of other initiatives, I think, should take.
Yeah, it's so cool to meet all of them too.
Yeah, they're amazing, huh?
Mm-hmm. They really are.
I haven't met any of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard this year because of COVID-19, but the Equator Prize ceremony this year is going to be all virtual, and actually a lot of these podcasts feature representatives from Equator Prize winners.
Oh, wow. That's really cool. So they've already chosen the people who won?
Yeah, the 2020 Equator Prize winners. I'll send you the link later.
Okay. Yeah, that's really powerful. I think that would make a huge difference for Indigenous peoples, because that's the way we pass down our knowledge. So if we were able to participate in these political systems and UN by just giving stories, I feel like that would really improve our ability to participate in like accessibility. I feel like my parents have, and my family and all elders, I've learned most of the lessons I've learned through just stories that they're telling, like at a dinner table or at a gathering. And I think that other people can learn that way as well.
Yeah, you're so right. I mean, the good stories and the bad stories, no matter how much there's an emotional burden, it's also important. And if it gets all the way to the UN level and affects some kind of agreement or inspires some country to sign on to the Paris Agreement or something tangible like that, it's good. But regardless, every single story is so valid, and I definitely think that all those stories should be told, because as you said before, it really allows other people who've experienced the same issue to relate to those people and then build that community, and that's the most valuable thing in the world, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And soon after I got to the UN, I actually started being a part of this organization called Tribal Link, and they invite about 15 to 20 Indigenous leaders from different countries around the world every year. and train them on how to participate in the UN system. And the venue is the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. So we help them write draft their statements. We help them navigate the UN system, teach them about the UN system, the history of Indigenous rights, and yeah, how to prepare. And find that a lot of Indigenous peoples, when they're writing their statements, they just want to tell a story. They just mm-hmm. That's their natural inclination. They start writing, and you know, the permanent forum only gives us like 2 minutes to deliver our statement.
Wow.
But when these Indigenous peoples get here, their first drafts are always stories. It's kind of sad because we have to get rid of a lot of it to stay within this 2 minute timeline, but also to deliver the sort of language that the UN is looking for and that the UN can action us mm-hmm. on.
Right. It ends up being so contrived and too concise.
Yes. And yeah, and the UN system feels like it can't take action on stories. Stories have to be like diluted, and I see that every year. And as Indigenous peoples, our strength is our storytelling. One of our strengths is our storytelling. It'd be really great, as you said, to utilize that like they did in Fiji.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I completely agree. Okay, so I'm gonna pivot a little bit and ask you about your experience as a legislative fellow in the U.S. House Natural Resource Subcommittee for Indigenous Peoples. Based on your experience in the legislative branch, what do you think the U.S. government can do better when it comes to mitigating the adverse effects of climate change, specifically on Native Americans, who are among the most vulnerable groups to climate change, at least in the United States?
Yeah, when it comes to climate change specifically, I think the U.S. government needs to do things that would protect everyone in the U.S. because Native Americans were one of the most vulnerable. But I think things that would really make this country safer for everyone would also help us. Some of that is like promoting renewable energy in a sustainable way. A lot of people don't know that when it comes to solar panels, there's a good way to do it, and there's also a really destructive way to build them. Yeah. And a lot of solar panels, the rare earth minerals that you need to build many of these solar panels come from places like China and Brazil, where they're mined often in indigenous people's territories.
Mm.
So people don't recognize, or they don't make the connection that solar panels require mining. And we need to think about that as well when we expand renewable energy. And make sure that we're doing that in a healthy way. But I do think renewable energy is much, much better solution, and that is necessary, not just for us, but for everyone. And mm-hmm. then I think a lot of Indigenous peoples are still struggling to maintain their rights to their land. We have a lot of traditional knowledge and a lot of solutions that we've been using for thousands of years to work with the land, to not enslave it, respect the land. And I think a lot of people can learn from us, but the only way that this can be formalized is giving us the final say when it comes to the land. Like when Indigenous peoples, you might have heard like the hashtag, or people say land back.
Land back.
Yeah. So a lot of Indigenous peoples say land back. That's the solution. And when people hear that, they think, oh, they're trying to kick us out, or they want all their land back. Where are we going to go? But we're not the same. Yeah, they're not the same. We're not the same. So like when the pilgrims landed in Massachusetts, we gave them food. We taught them how to grow. When Columbus arrived in Puerto Rico, the Taino were very welcoming. So we never were selfish about wanting to share this beautiful place. We always had a system where, you know, we respected guests and people who were just trying to better their lives, then turned bad on us and got selfish about it and enacted policies and genocide to really hurt us. It's still hurting us today. So when we say land back, we mean that we want our sovereignty back over the decision making when it comes to the land. So like we want a say in whether there will be mining on our land, on our traditional land we've been living on for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. We want a say for whether a river will be dammed. We want power when it comes to those decisions, and I think it's justified. So that's when we say land back, that's what we mean. We just want to protect Mother Earth and protect our land and our homes. And to actually be given formalized power and mechanisms to do so, that's based in our traditional political system. And so I think that's a huge aspect of what the U.S. government can do to formalize that voice in our Congress, maybe. I know in Australia, Aboriginal people are pushing for a voice in their parliament. The Sami in Norway and Finland, they have their own parliament that has, you know, equal power to the parliament of Finland or Norway. They're able to take an active role and be represented in those decisions. But I think, yeah, going into the future, we really do have a lot to give, and it's going to take political courage for the U.S. government to recognize that. I know, like just one maybe tangible example, you know, like when it comes to hunting, that's something we would want a voice in, really the last voice, to say how hunting will be regulated. We want to be able to hunt in our traditional lands, but for the longest time, the way that we hunted, we had policies for how it would work. First of all, we never hunted mothers. So the mothers, like the moose that were mothers or the deer that were mothers, we never hunted them during certain times of the year because we knew that they were pregnant. Mm-hmm. We knew the cycle, their life cycles. And this is just a tangible example of the knowledge that we have that can be translated into the law, that really no one else would be able to really advise on the way that we do.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, especially when you're closer to the environment. You feel a deeper need to take care of it if you know so much about it and have so much more local knowledge than someone who might come in and hunt in the area. Or maybe another example would be a solution to climate change is reforestation, but that ends up sometimes taking the form of unjust land grabbing and then taking that land away from the people who had lived there for millennia. So yes, I completely agree with all the points you made.
Yeah. I think that's so true. Thanks for putting it that way.
Thanks again, Victor. This brings us to the end, and I really appreciate you sharing your experience with us. Best of luck in your very, very important work. And for our listeners, stay tuned for the next episode of the Learning for Nature podcast. Till next time.
Thank you so much, Julie.